You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, we have another mailbag episode for you today. Excited to see what tangents, what rabbit holes we uncover. And just wanted to first give you the heads up again. If you want to know, how do I have my question? How do I get my feedback onto the show? Open offer here. All you need to do is just be a part of our weekly newsletter. Brad sends out a once a week newsletter and literally ask you, what is your feedback? What action have you taken? What ideas or topics would you like for us to discuss? If you'd like to be on that newsletter, just go to chooseify.com/subscribe. Speaking of Brad, I got my co-host here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. Yeah, we mentioned last week that we were going to do this again soon. I don't think we fully expected to do it quite this soon, but we had so much fun with the roundup that we're like, all right, this feels good. Let's do it again. So yeah, it's amazing how much feedback we get, right?
You know, it's criminal. I mean that word. It is criminal to not share all the feedback that we get, because Brad, going back to the very origins of the show, you described it as, you know, it's a virtuous loop, a virtuous cycle, and you put something out in the universe, people do their version of that, and to be honest with you, they take action. That's where it ends on most blogs, websites, etc. I remember being inspired back in the day by Mr. Money Mustache's blog and reading, you know, an article that he had done an incredible job putting together. And there would be hundreds, if not thousands, of comments, but you just got tired of clicking. You would get value from a few of them, but you would get tired of clicking, you know, to go read page after page. So these great ideas are just lost to the comments section. And we talked early on, how can we bring or feature some of these? And so I guess let's start there, just because I know you got an email about a comic book collection that I know resonated and sparked something in your own personal life recently.
Yeah, this was interesting. So yeah, unfortunately, I don't have the exact email to read verbatim, but someone wrote in saying they were talking about how asset prices have been going crazy for everything, right? And we've seen that with housing prices, right? You've seen that with stocks. It seems like asset prices are going up for everything. And this person said, oh, I have this old baseball card and comic book collection, and I didn't think it was worth anything. But then I looked into it, and lo and behold, it was worth something like $30,000 or something crazy like that. So that, again, that's from my recollection, but I'll tie this into my real life. And I try to put together just like these little pieces of information when I hear them. So I got this email, which obviously piqued my interest. I also had been following that guy, Gary Vee, you know, Gary Vaynerchuk, and he was talking about sports cards for like a year now. I'm like, what on earth is he talking about? It just seemed very out of nowhere. And then I listened to a podcast that I actually really like. It's a business podcast by the odd name of Animal Spirits. But it's these two guys just kind of, right? Business podcast named Animal Spirits. I saw your quizzical face there, John.
I just wonder, how do you find these podcasts? Like I'm legitimately, how do you add something to the queue? I don't know many other podcast hosts that listen to as many podcasts. And I'm sorry, I'm dragging you on a tangent here. That listen to as many podcasts as you. But like, are you, I personally, I've never opened up my podcast player and seen a suggested podcast and just clicked on it. If I'm listening to a podcast, it's because I got a recommendation and I want to find out, you know, all right, I'm going to go check this one out. That would be how I ingest or make a decision about a podcast. Is that what you do, or you legitimately look at what's trending on your, I don't know, CastBox or Player FM?
Yeah. So I guess in general, I do it a couple different ways. So yeah, I listen to an almost absurd number of podcasts, which is actually sadly a piece of stress in my life that I need to cut out in some capacity. But what I normally do is many podcast hosts are guests on other podcasts. Okay. So I will hear them as a guest and I'll say, oh, that guy or girl sounds really, really interesting. Hey, maybe I should subscribe to their podcast. That's an easy way. I do kind of look at, because as you know, Jonathan, finding a podcast is really, really difficult. I mean, there are a million plus podcasts, and unless you know the exact name of it, it's very difficult to find. So I just kind of look through the top 100 list of business podcasts and overall podcasts and just say, oh, does that sound interesting? Is it worth trying? So those are generally speaking the ways that I go about it. But I think in this case, I could be wrong, but I'm 99% sure in the case of Animal Spirits, our friend Chris Hutchins, who actually just started a podcast called All the Hacks, he told me about these guys who do Animal Spirits, and he gave me a particular episode to download, but I liked the podcast so much that I just subscribed to it. So
there you go. Animal Spirits, your business podcast of choice. So very cool. All right. I dragged you off. I'm sorry.
No. Okay. No, that's interesting. Cause yeah, I mean, I'm sure people wonder, like, you know, how do you find podcasts? So anyway, that's my method. Buyer beware, obviously. But in this case, they actually had someone who, I think they founded a website called Collectable. So it's Collectable, A-B-L-E. So kind of an odd spelling of it. And it winds up, and I'm not giving investment advice here. This is not something I've invested in at all. It was just, it sounded interesting. It was basically saying, okay, sports cards have risen in value dramatically. Most people can't afford a $800,000 Michael Jordan rookie card. But could you fractionalize it and basically own, like, akin to a stock, like a percentage ownership of that card? And now there's a lot of details. I'm not talking about this site in particular. I'm not invested in it, not giving advice. But, you know, they store it in a vault and they split it up into $10 share prices, et cetera. So anyway, I went to the website. It sounded interesting. And I looked at a card. I'm like, oh, wow, I have that card in my basement. And it was a 1980 Ricky Henderson rookie card.
Ricky Henderson.
Yeah. Who is, yeah, an all-time Hall of Famer and star. And yeah, in his old school Oakland Athletics jersey. And Jonathan, the crazy thing was the card was going for $145,000.
So theirs is in a vault surrounded by melted glass. Yours is inside of a Tupperware jar.
Yes. Mine is in a cardboard box down in my basement. Yep. Yeah, not all that far off. So, you know, it's funny. I don't think, again, I've ever mentioned this, but I used to work at a comic book and baseball card store when I was a kid. I was like 13 or 14, and that was my very first job. So I actually have a lot of old school from the early 1990s, late 1980s baseball cards and comic books. And I always kept them in really good condition. Because again, I worked at a store, so I knew what to put them in, how to store them, et cetera. But for decades now, I've been told these things are worthless. Every time I looked them up in, like, whatever it was, the old school, like, Beckett sports card guide, it was like, oh, your 1985 top set is worth $3.50. So, you know, it was something absurd. And I think only in the last year or two have sports cards been on this meteoric rise. And, you know, we can be dubious as to why the heck that has happened. That's a whole separate podcast. Let's not even maybe get into that unless you have a burning desire to do so. But it intrigued me. I'm like, so I went down and I pulled out all my baseball cards and comic books, and I kept picking out these cards that were like, holy cow, these cards are potentially really valuable. I've got like a Barry Sanders rookie card, a Scottie Pippen rookie card. I mean, old school, like in really, really good shape. Troy Aikman, I'm going through my list here. So I'm literally looking at the card, Jerry Rice rookie card. So all of this stuff. And it's like, okay, what are these things worth? Do I have to get them in a safe deposit box, which I'm actually, I am doing. So these things are not lying around at my house anymore. But the interesting thing that I've learned, and I will be quiet here, Jonathan, and let you interject for since I'm sure you have a bunch of questions, but it's all about getting these cards graded. Okay. So there's a grading service that basically, if they're graded perfectly mint, a 10 out of 10, they're worth a fortune. Like, this stack of cards that I have is probably worth more than my house. No joke. But if they're even like a 9.0, then they're probably worth maybe 10 grand at most. So it's insane, which is not bad, right? It's still found money, but it all comes down to this grading.
All right. You have given me so many like rants and rabbit holes and places to go off the rails here. Yeah. So many. All right. There's like 9 different directions. I'm trying to pick which one to start with. So one is, collectibles in general have always like baffled me. Totally bad. Like, and I'm not putting yours in the same category as Beanie Babies, but Beanie Babies baffled me. They did. They totally baffled me. All right. And clearly Beanie Babies are not the only collectible. Sports cards have been, it's been happening for a very long time. I am genuinely curious why they are valuable at all. And then, well, that's not totally it. I understand that to some varying degree, but why baseball cards? Like, do we know, like with all of these, how many of these cards were actually made? Like, is it a supply and demand? Obviously, how far the player actually went? Like, yes, the condition is one thing.
That's a great question. I actually have an answer.
Great.
So I think this is actually precisely why if it's a 10 out of 10, then it's worth something. And if it's even like a near mint, it is worth a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction. Because to answer your question, I don't think we know how many were actually produced on the front end, but we do know how many exist in the world that are graded 10.0. So it is truly a scarcity issue. Okay. So regardless of whether there are 5 million Ricky Henderson cards from 1980, there are only, and I'm making this number up, but it's not that far off. There are only 7 in the world that are graded 10.0. Okay. So it comes down to why is almost anything valuable? It's scarcity. That's how human beings work, right? So I think that partially answers your question. And I had that exact question of like, you don't know how many, and it's conceivable that another 7 10.0s are out there somewhere in a cardboard box like mine was. Now, mine is not a 10.0. I can see it just visually. It's pretty close, but it's not. And again, that means it's not worth 140. If it's worth a couple thousand, it would be a lot. So, you know, I'm tempering my expectations here. I don't have any reason to believe this is worth a fortune.
Before you send this off to a grader, in your mind, what score are you giving this collection of cards that you have?
Yeah, I think some to many of them, because I did keep them in good shape and like, you know, the exact containers that you were supposed to, heavy duty, like they should be in the 9.0 region. I would be very surprised if most of these were less than that. This Ricky Henderson one is actually, I can see a visual defect on it, so it's not going to be that high even. But yeah, we'll see. It wouldn't shock me if one of them came back at a 10, but that would be one out of 30 cards that could potentially be valuable.
All right, this sets me up for my next rant, which is like with most collectibles, and I'm thinking specifically of like action figures at this point. So forget Beanie Babies, leave Beanie Babies. Let's move to the action figures, which most of us were guilty for, whether you're talking about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or little Batman action figures or G.I. Joes or whatever, Star Wars, yeah. Anybody?
I actually found 2 Star Wars figures mint in box from 1983.
Right. Let me talk about it. This is a child that's getting this Star Wars container. And then the rule is, no, but this is a collectible, this investment. But daddy, I want to play with it. No, this is a collectible. This is an investment. You do not unbox it. You do not play with it. You do not touch it. It stays in the box. Like, what?
Oh, Jonathan. You know what's so funny is you're bringing up this memory from, I think I scarred my cousin Danny for life when I literally had that exact conversation when I was the worldly 13-year-old who worked at the baseball card store. And Beanie Babies literally were the hot collectible. He got them for, I think it was like Hanukkah or something. I scarred him for life by saying, do not open it. You can't play with it. Almost verbatim what you just said in your fictional retelling.
No, it's real. It's real.
Oh, it was real.
All right. So the next layer of this, we're going really far with this. I'm sorry, but this is there's a final thing.
A roundup gone bad here,
No. Tangent. All right. So the next one is, why do we think, and we don't actually have an answer for this one, why do we think that for years, these things languished in Beckett's book of pricing for $3.50, and now suddenly it's $150,000. Like, did the demand just change? Did we have some way of recognizing that the way we were grading these before, really, you know, we were thinking these were all priced around, oh, they minted 2 million of these cards, but we realized what you just said, oh, there's actually only 10 of these in existence out of 10 of 10, so they are now scarce and you can't get these. Like, Brad, is there any, I mean, really, I'm not talking about just a gradual increase, but like a Beckett's valuing these at $3 or $10. And now suddenly you find out that the actual market demand for these is an astonishing $30,000, $50,000, $150,000. Like, there's more than just, you know, people being interested in collectibles now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is a very complex and nuanced question that I do not have a satisfactory answer for. I suspect, and I think I've even seen this just in the last couple months since I've found this craziness, is it seems like there was a bubble that is popping to some degree. So like, you know, that Michael Jordan card that I referenced before was, I think one of them sold for $800,000 and then the most recent one, a handful of months later, sold for $200,000, which okay. is still nothing to sneeze at, right? For a piece of cardboard, but that's a 75%, you know, knock on the price, right? So, I mean, whoever bought that card at $800,000 a handful of months ago is not feeling all that great. So,
well, that actually, I mean, the reason why I was asking that, and you answered it perfectly, is that it really informs whether or not we should be excited about fun money and get unload these while people are still crazy enough to value a baseball card at $150,000, et cetera. I'm sorry, the personal bias coming through there. but like versus, well, if it's worth this now, you know, if you hold on to it for another 20 years or 30 years, even more scarce, there's more fractional shares, NFT, someone's going to want to build a whole vault around this single Ricky Henderson card graded at a 9.0, and then it'll be worth whatever, whatever. I should hold on to it, you know, as long as I possibly can. This is my retirement fund. And like my gut bias would be just run, you know, but the fact that that doesn't hold true across all people, like could be, I could be wrong. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to know, right? I mean, but that's the beautiful thing about even down to this, about the old adage of personal finance is personal, right? I mean, we're talking about baseball cards. You wouldn't normally consider this personal finance, but it's money related, very obviously. And, you know, if this is something that you just think is worth absolutely nothing, then of course you're not going to put your money into it, right? Like my bias is similar to yours, which is, man, if I could cash these things out for any kind of money, things that have been sitting in my basement for a long time, and
you
I can thought
actually
we're worth
justify
it.
To Laura why you stored them, you know, in the basement, taking up space for this long. You're like, see, this is why you should right. enable my bad habits of, you know, borderline hoarding here with the cards.
Yeah, seriously, that would be a very nice moment. But yeah, I mean, there, and this is not to say that all things that people place value on that aren't just traditional real estate or stocks or businesses like have no value. It is truly in the eye of the beholder. Like I can't imagine spending millions of dollars on a piece of art, right? But there are many people that do and place value on that precisely because of some combination of scarcity. Maybe they actually like the piece, they want it hanging, but a lot of it is signaling, right? Like, I mean, there's some interesting combination of speculation, right? Like, or a place to park your assets if you have more money than you know what to do with. I'm like, I wouldn't make that argument, but that's why people do. So is it preposterous to think that somebody wants to buy a Michael Jordan rookie card? I mean, I don't think it's preposterous. Like, would I do it? No, obviously I wouldn't.
I mean, I'd be pretty excited if I had a Michael Jordan rookie card, and I probably wouldn't, you know. So all right. Now, we did a very long setup and you didn't know this was coming, but I had this place in mind. All of this leading to the idea of beware of false scarcity. Beware of false scarcity that has 100 years of marketing behind it. All right. So this is one. You know
diamonds.
Where I'm going now.
Tell me you're going with diamonds.
I'm going with diamonds. We're
oh,
going
baby,
there.
I knew it.
All right. If you have not yet realized this, you have been us collectively, me, my wife, Brad's wife, everybody, humanity, has been marketed diamonds in an unbelievable manner for over 100 years. Diamonds are forever. The problem is diamonds are also not scarce at all. They are like leaves, barely more scarce than leaves. The way that they are made scarce is through taking them off the market by companies, right? Like there are large corporations that withhold all the diamonds so that they can leak them to maintain some level of supply and demand. This is not my opinion. This is a fact. And I say that because people get very excited and fixated about their diamonds and how much they spent on those diamonds. You have been played. You have been played. If the market were actually free, those diamonds would not be worth. Well, you basically find this. Go try to sell your diamonds. I mean, you can find out. Go get a quote on how much your ring is actually worth. And you will be disappointed likely. And so this actually sets us up like one, like what if I want to research this further, Brad? We talked with someone a while back and they did a wonderful article around this that we could actually have linked. Maybe you could provide some more context, but just to really reset yourself around this whole diamonds are forever mantra. And I just kind of laugh when I hear the radio commercials in my car after having realized this.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was furiously trying to go through our email system to see if I could pull up. I know we got at some point an email a couple years ago from someone who was talking about precisely this and how they wound up getting a, what is it, cubic zirconia ring. And, you know, it looked beautiful and it was essentially the same thing. They weren't kidding themselves. So if we can pull that up, we'll link to it in the show notes, but that might be a hard find from a couple of years ago. But it reminds me, Jonathan, of, as you're describing that, and in fairness, I am sure you're right, but I haven't done the research on that with the diamonds, but it actually reminds me of the concept of, like, when you're describing, if you go to resell it, you're going to get a tiny, tiny little fraction. Anywhere where people are putting in so much money into the upfront sales and marketing, you probably have a sense that you're going to get ripped off in some way. And it reminds me, this is probably one of the few direct connections between rings and timeshares.
I was thinking next timeshare. That was my next one.
but the connection was made in my brain of, like, yep, right? Like, timeshares are the exact same thing as you were describing. I'm like, well, damn, like, if you went to resell a timeshare that you bought for $15,000, like, if you get 500 for it, you're lucky. They're virtually worthless, which is why they spend all this money. They are the best salesmen in the world, right? They spend all this money to get you there, to give you free stuff, shower you in things. They have the hard sell, and it's all that money up front. And, you know, again, as you're describing that with the diamonds, like, it is not dissimilar at all, right?
It is not. So we're going to share an article. Now, it was actually written by Ellen Massicott. I think I said her last name correctly. Yeah. And she writes over at Free to Pursue. But this particular article she did as a guest post on frugalfringe.com. So a little transit there. We'll have a link. Brad, I'm giving Brad the link right now. We'll make sure it gets included in the show notes for this episode. But she breaks down, you know, she goes into much more detail around this idea, you know, how the market is actually controlled, what your options are, you know, and people are slowly waking up to this. Like, to your point, you can just make one, right? You could, if you wanted to, you could make it. Cubics are, there's like five different ways that you can make a diamond if you want to have a diamond of stunning brilliance. In fact, one of the ways they say that diamonds are more valuable is because of the unique characteristics of its flaw. Think about that. So Brad, with yours, if your cards have any flaw whatsoever, it loses 90% of its value. With diamonds, they're like, well, because you can make perfect ones all the time, it's actually the unique characteristics of the flaw that make the diamond more valuable. So, you know, all right. I just, when you see this, you can't unsee it. Not only can you make a perfect diamond with higher quality, higher brilliance, higher everything, but the ones that are out there are actually incredibly plentiful. And all that would need to happen would be for them to stop withholding the massive supply that they have and let the market be flooded with it, and your diamonds are basically worthless. So if you have diamonds and a lot of money invested in them, either unload them while people are still willing to pay top dollar, or two, hope that they never unwind the actual true supply. So, and with the timeshares, yeah, Brad, you made that point. If you are being marketed to perpetually, think about that. If you're actually getting full value, where's the money to market these things perpetually? If it is being marketed, that means that it is marked up, right? There has to be enough profit to market and sell these things. And I could keep going with this idea, but timeshares, there are so many people that spend an inordinate amount of time trying to figure out how to escape them. How do I escape this timeshare? It has become quite the burden. So false scarcity and marketing are a very dangerous combination for your wallet and your financial health and wealth. So just apply a loose layer of skepticism, you know, a little bit of cynicism with these, and, you know, use some best practices as it applies to your financial goals.
Hey, this is Andrew from the Choose FI team. Hope you're enjoying the show. We're going to get right back to it after these quick messages.
All right, Brad. Well, we have spent a decent amount of time there. I once I got the bit, I couldn't let go of it until we went farther down the diamond rabbit hole. But why don't we move back to the mailbag?
Yeah. So, Jonathan, I got a couple of quick emails here that are interesting. We'll start the first one from Jeff. And Jeff wrote in, I used a service called Trim to negotiate my internet and cell phone bills. I was able to lock in savings of $45 a month for the next year. So $540 in total savings. It took less than an hour to sign up and link my accounts. I wish I had known about this service sooner. Now, Jonathan, this piqued my interest because I know you've used either this service or one that's very, very similar, right? Where you sign up and then they go and negotiate on your behalf, right?
I did. Yeah, I used billfixers.com, but I am very partial just to one of these services. So Billfixers or Trim, I'm sure you can Google either of those. I know with Trim, just go to choosefi.com/trim. You'll find the link there. But yeah, I mean, to your point, all of us have regular recurring utilities. And what I love about these is that they actually will proactively do this on your behalf. So they put little tasks in there. You know, this person, we renewed their contract for their cable package in 2020. All right. We know that they had their rate locked in for 2 years. Why don't we proactively go and negotiate on their behalf? And so you'll get an email alert for them at the end of that stint saying, hey, we're going in and we're renegotiating for you. We're going to get, you know, some sort of alert about two-factor authentication. Just give us that and we'll complete this again. So it's like, you don't even need it in your Todoist, Brad, because they're proactively got it on theirs because that's their profit motive. That's their profit incentive. The way these usually work is they don't charge you anything up front. You just pay them a percentage or a fee based on whatever it is that they save you. So considering you would not do this on your own, you can just do a set and forget approach where you do it one time and they work on your behalf going forward. It's highly rated and reviewed. I've been very, very satisfied. And I think that most people would benefit just from having a negotiator on their behalf for these utilities that frankly, they don't want to call them.
Yeah, right. You don't want to call them. You don't know the exact words to use. And you don't know what is being offered to other people, right? When you have a service like this, and they've made this call 100,000 times to Verizon or Comcast or whichever service, they know precisely what's available, right? Like for you, it's a black box.
You're absolutely right. And so Brad, you've experienced this in credit cards. Sometimes when you've, you know, applied for a credit card in the past, and for whatever reason, it said, we're pausing to consider, or we're not going to do it at this time. Like people in the travel space very much know that there is a script, that there is a decision tree that customer service agents have. And you, depending on your precise wording, you're going to go down one fork or the other. And then each one of those forks has a sub fork and you can unlock pretty significant extra value by just knowing that. So I don't have any specifics on that side, but I can tell you all of us have probably recognized that we said the wrong thing when we called our cable company. Like we saw that really great offer just disappear because we said the wrong thing. We're like, oh, can I get that back? How do I get that back? I don't know what their script is. And I don't know how I screwed up or what word I said, but they do because they have done this over and over again. And I promise you, customer service agents at companies like this don't get paid enough to use free will or make their own choices. They are following a choose your own adventure path guidebook, like, you know, or whatever it is, fill in the blank here. All right, go to page 36 and read one of these options out. That's it. That's all that's happening. You know it. So why would you want to be the one to have to refigure this out? I don't have the energy or the time to do that. Let someone else that's got it perfected do it. They'll do a much better job acting on your behalf.
Yeah, I love it. All right, Jonathan, speaking of loving things, you are going to flip for this next email. So Bill wrote in saying, my 1% better this week is helping my daughters with their very first lemonade stand. I helped them with making signs for marketing, but then we thought, why don't we reach further? So they made Facebook videos the 5 days before, hyping it up. We listed our Venmo account. So if people wanted to just donate, they could. They walked away with over $130 in just 1 hour. And the best part is they understood how promoting the event reached way more people than the signs did.
That's incredible.
I love that. Love, love, love.
I have something to stack on to this just because you said lemonade stand very specifically. I don't know if this is sarcasm or not, but you'll recognize the inherent truth in what I'm about to read. Eric says, my daughter made $110 on her lemonade stand today in like an hour. It turned out people were handing her $5 and $10, and she was just assertively saying, thank you for the tip, and not offering change.
Oh, man, that's fantastic.
So,
I don't know. She sold 5 glasses of lemonade.
I don't know if he's being serious or not, but I'm like, you know, let's be very clear, though. All businesses are doing a version of this now. They are all like, I don't care how, you know, when you go into the little store and they turn around the little cubicle to you and it's already got your tip there. And it's like, do you want to do 5% or 10%? It's like, I'm just picking up my order. I just paid you for the order. What's the tip? You know, like there's literally no interaction. I'm interacting with a computer, but like no tip is all the way on the very end. Like no tips all the way on the very end. And you're like, man, I'm the dirty person that actually has to tell them now I don't want to do a tip. I guarantee you. A lot of people leave tips. I don't know what to do with that information. It kind of irritates me at some level. I don't mind tipping, but I'm like, you just set a price. Why do I need to, you know, anyway, I'm going down a different place here, but This was looking at like marketing and going to a very extreme place with it very early in the game. And I was like, well, respect. it's different.
Yeah. That is very, very creative. And yeah, I hear you. It is hard to know how to navigate that kind of tipping thing. I've seen that with, yeah, I'm picking up a pizza or something and it shows up tip. And now obviously, like, I'm someone who, I mean, I have many members of my family who were waiters and waitresses. So I know how hard the service industry is. We tip exceptionally well when we go out, but it is hard to navigate when it's something that there isn't normally a tip associated, but you feel like you're being cheap if you're putting zero. So,
a waiter or waitress scenario. Literally,
right,
you're
picking up a pizza at the counter like normal. Yeah. There's a price for it.
Getting a coffee, getting a like it's, you know, you're not making me a pour over cup here. I just got it from the freaking coffee pot over here. All right. Anyways.
Yeah. So tangent. But yeah, tipping is obviously very, very important, but we are not saying that. That's not the situation we're describing here. It's tough to navigate. So no question about it. All right. We got a good one here. So this is from Justin. And Justin said, I had to share this great idea my wife had as we are on our FI journey and really trying to become financially independent in the next few years. We recently had our son, and my wife is getting ready to go back to work when she realized most of her clothes don't fit her anymore. Instead of going to the store and buying new clothes or trying to layer as much as she could, she decided to post on Nextdoor. So there's a website called Nextdoor. I know we have that. We have a community one here locally. I'm sure they're all over the place. Asking if anyone had any clothes they want to get rid of. Long story short, our whole bedroom is covered with, quote, new clothes now. And she has 2 to 3 completely new wardrobes.
Wow.
It's really cool. Now we need to figure out the best of the best. So there's no decision fatigue when getting ready. Now the problem has become an abundance. So that's really cool. I know your wife, Dani, loves the Buy Nothing groups, right? Which is, I've never seen Nextdoor used in this manner, but clearly Freecycle and Buy Nothing are ways that are set up for this type of thing. When you're done using it, right, and you don't want to throw it in the landfill, clearly, there's somebody else that can use it. So yeah, I'd love to hear just a little bit about that.
Dani is unbelievably proactive. She joins mom's Facebook groups in local areas. She does participate in Buy Nothing. She is on Nextdoor, and she also cultivates personal relationships for clothing for kids. So with our neighbors, you know, she's gotten to know the neighbors. All of us have kids under 5, you know, at various ages. And so I see the kids across the street wearing clothes that I know we picked up a couple of years back, and vice versa. Dani has organized clothes being handed off when they're too young. So those clothes collectively between the neighbors that she coordinates with get a lot of use. We have a lot of toys flow into the house from like Buy Nothing groups. And I also see toys disappear sometimes as well. So, there is a way to circulate these things. I tell you, my kids just get bored of toys. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's always a new toy. It's never the toy they had last week. And so we actually got a great tip from Jillian, host of the Everyday Courage podcast. And she was talking about with a large family, just, you know, it's minimalism by necessity. And one of the things that she did is when her kids were not valuing or not enjoying or appreciating the toys in any way, she would just, while they were asleep, come down with a big, you know, Tupperware. I guess, well, I don't know. I feel like I've said Tupperware recently 2 times. I don't know where it's, is that the right term for this? It's not Tupperware. It's like tubs, those Rubbermaid tubs.
Big tubs with, Rubbermaid tubs.
Rubbermaid tubs. I'm sure other people make them too, but for this. And she just bundles it up, like 2 or 3 of these, and she gets them into the attic. And so they end up with like 25, 30% of all their toys at a time. And then as the season switches, suddenly the kids get to see the tub come back down. And, well, what do you know? Suddenly they appreciate this toy, you know, that they haven't cared less about 3 months ago. Now it's a new one being internet. So Dani does something similar, just kind of rotating them in and out and getting more enjoyment out of it. The one thing that my wife does that is just amazing is the joy that she and the kids get out of cardboard. No cardboard comes to our house without getting repurposed. And whether she's making like a some sort of Halloween outfit out of it or a fort or a submarine or whatever, people who follow her on Facebook are pretty quick to notice that the cardboard is well purposed in our house and usually doesn't escape before being covered in duct tape.
Yeah, it's amazing how much usefulness you can get out of cardboard. That's for damn sure. I've seen Dani in walking into your house a bunch of times with these just crazy projects. She's incredibly resourceful and just has an amazing imagination. I can't imagine what your kids' imaginations are like.
Yeah, it's fun to watch. And I'm nice. Definitely proud of kind of watching their creative spark get led and excited to see Dani working with them. So fun
That's
stuff.
Super cool. All right, Jonathan, we got an email here from Rachel. And I thought this was so interesting because it's kind of a little rethink on how we normally phrase the conversation, but it ties very precisely with how I think you and I have evolved the message of FI, which I think a lot of people say, oh, that's not FI, right? Yeah, I hear that ridiculous, like, oh, you're spending more money. Oh, that's not FI. As if the only way to be on the path to financial independence is to just live in deprivation and cut ruthlessly. Like, you and I have rejected that wholeheartedly. And we've said, you spend money on what you value. And I think that's where Rachel's email comes in here. And she said, this week, my 1% better involved deciding to spend more money on convenience services, and I have zero regrets. A couple of weeks ago, we learned that my husband will be deploying with his National Guard unit on October 1st for over a year, about 5 weeks after our second daughter is born. While this will obviously bring an immense amount of challenge into our lives, financial matters won't be a part of it. Because of the financial space that we've created in our lives, the change in income won't have a negative impact on our ability to live day to day, and will even provide for an increase in, quote, convenience spending while he is gone. Having the flexibility to hire out lawn care, snow plowing, and cleaning in our home without a financial burden will be extremely helpful in reducing my workload as I navigate being a new mom to two on my own and allowing me to focus on what needs my attention the most, our girls. It's not a typical 1% better for FI, but it is absolutely a value choice that will make our time during deployment better by much more than 1%. How great is that, John?
It is. You know, you were saying this earlier, and I know we both resisted carving out Fat FI as its own unique thing, or Lean FI as its own, you know, unique thing, or it's just you're pursuing financial independence. Yeah, some people are going to spend more, some people are going to spend less. It's an equation. And to say like, well, we're just pursuing Lean FI is like assuming that like the equation always stays the same. Everything stays static. When you embrace this idea of aggregation of marginal gains, you might have more control over spend less when you get started. And you might have more control over, you know, just optimizing what those investments are. But you create some space. And if you've written off earn more, well, that's writing off one third of the equation. You know, it might not be right for this moment in time. But as you get more ideas and you figure out what works for you, maybe you do embrace earn more. And so, you know, I think people are real quick to put themselves into a little box on how, what their flavor of FI is. And I would just say, well, maybe, but it's a stage of life. It's a season of life, right? And there's amazing stuff to be learned from people that are spending incredible vast amounts of money on what it is they value, but the equation still works for them. And there's incredible value to watching how people are able to get more for what some people would consider way too low an amount. It can act as an anchor on both sides. And, you know, I can't tell you how many people I've talked to that they are past the point of ever needing to worry about how they're going to fund their expenses for the rest of their life. And they're afraid to spend the dollar. And now they're operating from a place of fear. And like, you know, if you're happy, that's great. But if it's causing its own issues, then you would benefit from seeing other people that are on the path to FI that are comfortable spending more. So I don't know. It's so hard to give that one answer to that one person, but it's important. I think that we're all in this together and we're living our lives out in front of each other while recognizing that there's nuance here. And I think this is one thing that people struggle with kind of like this baby step approach, is that it's going to always look the same forever. You have to be on these three steps, and then you just do this, and then you do this, and you can never use a credit card. And it just, that doesn't make sense. It's not logical. Like, we have a goal. Our goal is to get to the place where we're financially independent. It's financial independence over your whole life. And there's nuance.
Yeah, there's nuance. And frankly, spending money can be a good thing, right? It doesn't have to be an evil. I think it's condemned so much in some of these circles, right? Where, oh, like I said, again, you know, that ridiculous, oh, that's not FI. I reject that completely. I mean, there are times where spending money on conveniences just simply makes your life better. If I value my time with my kids, an hour with my kids at, I don't know, I'm just making it up, at $100 an hour, and it's going to cost me $12 an hour to pay somebody to do something, I'm, you know, I'm just making up a fictional thing here. Of course, I'd rather spend the time with my kids, especially if my time was scarce, right? If you reframe that to, okay, what would I rather be doing and what could I pay to get this done for? Well, I mean, that might change the game. And, you know, even down to something that might seem frivolous. Like, Jonathan, recently I've been trying to experiment. I think we talked about this with Jillian when we had her on a couple episodes ago, of just kind of like random everyday adventures, even when they're not massive things that you would consider an adventure. And I recently saw a friend at the pool who had the telltale signs of that that cupping therapy. You know that thing? Like if you ever watch the Olympic swimming, you see these crazy marks on people's backs. And she was telling me how it's made her, she was near surgery. And, you know, of course, this is an anecdote, you know, please, anybody in the medical industry listening to me, just close your ears for a second. But, and she had a fantastic time and it's really helped her dramatically. So I'm like, you know what? I've always wanted to try that. What would it hurt? Right? It's going to cost me $70 or something.
Did you do, well, you had started this story before, but you hadn't done it at that point. Have you done it yet?
I have done it. So yeah, I actually went back for a second round recently, but I have felt fantastic. For the last couple of years, I've had neck and shoulder pain to the point where I would need to go to the chiropractor fairly often, which is an expense, obviously. So I haven't been to the chiropractor in months now. And while, of course, I can't attribute it directly to this, and you know,
you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, that's true.
And in your mind, you're attributing it directly to this. Just say it out loud.
I'm directly attributing it. Yeah. And it could be a placebo and all that stuff. But I feel fantastic, Jonathan. I feel great. And you know, it's like an hour massage and this cupping therapy. And I walk out of there feeling like $1 million. It's fantastic. I think before I went to these two, I'd had two massages in my, no, actually that's not true. I had one massage in my entire life. So this is now second and third in my entire life. And it feels great.
Yeah. So we have some confounding variables here. Was it the massage or the cupping?
Right,
but either
right,
way, right. Yeah, it's a little bit of form of experimentation.
Right. And what's the downside? Sure. Is it a frivolous expense? Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, I could obviously cut it out and my life is not going to be like appreciably worse, but it didn't hurt me at all to spend that money. And I feel great. And again, even if it's a placebo, I feel fantastic. So I'm not complaining at all. So anyway, long story short, obviously, Rachel's example here is much more pertinent than mine, but spending money is not always a terrible thing. And I think if a lot of us can internalize that, I think we'll give ourselves a little bit more grace, you know, a little bit more slack to just say, you don't have to beat yourself up about every dollar you spend. I think, Jonathan, you know, that's something we're trying to get across here at Chooseify is, you don't have to beat yourself up. This is not the place for that. This is a community of people trying to live better lives. And that definition comes down to you. And it's very personal.
All right, my friends. Thanks for joining us for our mailbag episode. Let me just encourage you again. If you have a comment, you have a question, you have something, a win you want to share with the community, we would love for you to join us on these conversations. And the easiest way to do that is just to be a part of our newsletter. Brad sends out a once a week newsletter asking you for the one thing you took action on, asking you open-ended question for your feedback and ideas. What is it that you're struggling with on your path to FI? Give us the chance to incorporate that into the conversation. Just go to chooseify.com/subscribe. The fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.